This is an ABC podcast.
The form of activism that you see in Moscow, but also other places, I think is formed by the despotism that exists in those places.
The Chinese government to extradite people from Hong Kong and try them for crimes committed in Hong Kong in Chinese courts. It was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for Hong Kong civil society.
Many of the features of these new despotisms are to be found inside so-named democracies. And more than that, that democracies can be transformed into despotisms quite quickly.
Amanda Tattersall, Kurt Iverson and John Keane talking about the rise of a new form of political power that's taking shape in several countries around the world. From China to Russia, from Turkey to Hungary, John Keane argues in his new book, The New Despotism, that despotism is now a serious threat to democracy.
The case in point, if you don't believe this, is Hungary. Under Orban, it took only 10 years for Hungary, inside the European Union, to be shifted from a constitutional power-sharing democracy with an active civil society and a free press and an independent judiciary into a Russian-style despotism. Through elections, through neutering the judiciary, by taming the parliament, by destroying important parts of the civil society, all inside the European Union, all within a decade. So the warning that runs through the new despotism is that democracies should pay attention to their clear alternative to the dangers of despotism. And for that, we can thank Montesquieu.
You're in the Philosopher's Zone on RN with me, David Rutledge. And today, producer Dallas Rogers is talking with John Keane, Professor of Politics at the University of Sydney, about his book, The New Despotism. In that book, John revives the 17th century French political philosopher Montesquieu's notion of despotism to make sense of the governance of countries like Russia and China today. You'll also hear from Amanda Tattersall and Kurt Iverson, also from the University of Sydney, about their work in Russia and China with the people who are trying to speak back to these despotic regimes. But at this point, I'll hand over to Dallas, who begins by asking John Keane about Montesquieu's interest in the monarchy of his time.
Of central concern to Montesquieu was the rule of Louis XIV, the so-called Sun King, who died in 1715. Montesquieu was not impressed by Louis XIV. Corrupt, suspicious, jealous, had maltreated religious minorities, above all the Huguenots. Montesquieu married a Huguenot, and for Montesquieu, Louis XIV was an exemplar of the dangers of arbitrary power. The early work of Montesquieu is about that monarchy and its corruption and the dangers it posed for France and for the rest of Europe.
What does he mean by arbitrary power here?
Arbitrary power is when people in institutions determine the fate of other people without check and balance, without accountability mechanisms being applied to that top-down power relationship. And you would expect that that lawlessness, that arbitrariness of power is resisted. The paradox, as Montesquieu showed in great detail, the paradox is that there can be situations where that arbitrary power is accepted, where it actually cultivates the loyalty of subjects. It produces a willingness to conform, a kowtowing, a predisposition to voluntary servitude, which is, you know, a phrase that's oxymoronic, but a kind of servitude that's willingly given, where it's as if subjects render themselves powerless by granting their power to the powerful. That's voluntary servitude.
So a few years ago, Xi Jinping gave a speech and
kind of articulated what became known as the red line for Hong Kong, which was if anybody speaks of self-determination for Hong Kong, autonomy for Hong Kong, they've kind of crossed the red line into something that's unacceptable, and the state will clamp down on that action. And that was after the umbrella movement had happened, and after that, the kind of deflation of civil society in the wake of that attempt to get a democratic election for the chief executive of Hong Kong.
Kurt suggests the discussion that follows the red line speech shows how the Chinese government is using a form of arbitrary power to constrain civil society in Hong Kong. And the government recently turned the red line speech into law with the enactment of the National Security Law. But the irony of this use of arbitrary power is that the Chinese government does have a degree of popular support in mainland China. And this is what Montesquieu is getting at with his idea of voluntary servitude, which he writes about in his book, The Spirit of the Laws.
The Spirit of the Laws, the Esprit des Lois, published in 1748. It's several hundreds of pages long. It took him at least 20 years to write. And it's a reflection on different types of government and the best form of government. It's widely and correctly credited for being one of the very first great early modern works of what would later become the analysis of politics, of political arithmetic, of later political science. Striking is the way that Montesquieu turns inside out old taxonomies of government according to whether it was ruled by one, you know, tyranny, ruled by a few, aristocracy, or the rule by many, democracy. He doesn't think in those terms. Instead, he introduces three basic forms of government, and he calls them republics, monarchies, and despotism. And each of these forms of government, says Montesquieu, have peculiar sets of institutions where there is a spirit of government that is infused among the population and those who govern. Spirit is very important for Montesquieu.
What does he mean by spirit here?
It's not a religious term. It's a term to describe the shared sentiments, the shared beliefs, the shared sense of legitimacy of institutions. And he points out that when whole political systems destroy that spirit, destroy that legitimacy, then they very easily crumble or collapse outright.
So three forms of government. Let's start with the first one, republics.
He has in mind that every republic, such as the Dutch Republic or the Roman Republic or the Swiss or Venice, that republics are typically small. They're infused with a spirit of political virtue, as he calls it. There is a sense of public spirit that private greed are not cool. He points out that there are different kinds of republics, and it's a bit complicated. Some are more democratic and some are more aristocratic, depending on to what extent the people are involved in government. Republics can only function on a small scale, he says, and they can only function when there is commitment to the public good. He thinks that the great danger in republics is when they suffer overstretch, for example, engage in military campaigns. That was a key reason why the Roman Republic destroyed itself. And republics are vulnerable to popular disturbances. He's not a small-d democrat. And generally, Montesquieu thinks that republics don't have a future in the modern world. It turns out that he was wrong about that, because Montesquieu played a very important role as the animator of the American Revolution and the discussions about the American Constitution, the attempt to build a new kind of modern republic.
Yeah, you write about that in your other book, The Life and Death of Democracy. It's an important story. But let's stay with the spirit of the laws. What's the second type of government? Montesquieu's a bit of a monarchist, isn't he?
Montesquieu was a monarchist, but not in a simple, straightforward way. When describing monarchy as a type of government, he of course says that its key feature is that there is a monarch and there are rules about succession. It's a kind of government where honour, not political virtue as in republics, but honour is its guiding spirit. You know, that mean-spiritedness is unacceptable, that people know their place in the world and they are willing to submit themselves to that hierarchy of power. He points out that monarchy needs to have a separation of powers. So a parliament is considered by him to be an important part of a monarchy, a bicameral system where there are two chambers, where the judiciary is separated from the legislative power. A well-functioning monarchy is one where there is a check and balance of power, in which there is a very strong sense that following established laws is important. Lawlessness destroys monarchy. So does the concentration of power, so does the erosion of honour. And for Montesquieu, the great danger that haunts monarchy is despotism.
Part of what we have been finding, isn't it, is that in those contexts, the form that opposition takes is so deeply shaped by the kind of wider political context and the opportunity structures that are there or not there when you're in a kind of more authoritarian or despotic regime.
Yeah.
Kurt Iverson and Amanda Tattersall again.
The thing that struck me about Moscow was, you know, there were lots of tiers of activists. I mean, Moscow and Russia has quite a vibrant protest culture. It's not true to say that there's no protest culture in Moscow. It's just terrifying to be a protester. And I met and interviewed, you know, this woman who lived in this tiny little flat where she was defending her park. And two things struck me. First, this woman was an everywoman. This woman was the equivalent of a woman fighting WestConnex in Sydney or some road over an arbitrary park anywhere in the world. Like, so it was the first time she'd ever done any form of activism. But as part of her struggle, she'd been manhandled by a bunch of thugs wearing black in the middle of the night when they were blocking a road, right? Like, the stakes for protest are so high. The other man that I interviewed, he'd had a death threat. It was just so direct. You know, like, I think sometimes we like to think that they're the subtle arm of the state is going to stop us people to not protest. It wasn't subtle at all. These people were being scared out of stopping an apartment block. It's not like they were saying, get rid of the president or something like that. That's what politics is like in Moscow. It's very direct. It's very rough. It occurs, but it comes at a high cost.
So despotism is a way of governing, but it also shapes people's lives. And Montesquieu has much to say about this in The Spirit of the Laws.
Despotism is the third type of government. He fears it. He despises it. What's interesting is that Montesquieu is really the first early modern thinker who makes this category very central to the analysis of power and politics and ethics. It's, of course, a very old word that goes back at least to the Greeks, where a despot had a positive connotation. A despot was the male head of household who ruled over his children, wives, and slaves, and did so with some measure of beneficence. Later, the term was revived in early modern Christian Europe to refer to Eastern forms of power, to China, to the subcontinent of India, to Persia, to the world of Islam. Montesquieu gives it a different twist. He basically says that a great danger that confronts the modern world is a thoroughly modern form of power which rules through fear. Fear is its central spirit. It is a form of government that is arbitrary power in its purest form. where the population is cowed, manipulated, bullied, seduced, for example, by luxury. You know, Montesquieu has much to say about the rise of modern capitalism and the culture of luxury that is associated with commodity production and exchange. And he thinks that despotisms of the kind that Louis XIV was building, that despotisms find clever ways of nurturing the servitude of their subjects. But the worst feature of despotism for Montesquieu is that it is ruled by a single capricious despot who is prone to violence, who fills his immediate courtiers with fear, who spreads the culture of fear, and who is prone to recklessness. Well, this, according to Montesquieu, the great danger that confronts monarchies is that they will degenerate into despotisms. And the problem with despotism is that it destroys liberty. It destroys a pluralism of institutions. It destroys law. And it is a great threat to the precious liberties of association, of the press, of rule of law, for which he stood.
There is just so much in there that reminds me of what I see today when I look around the world. You talk about lawlessness, rising power, the lack of check and balances, or actually the winding back of checks and balances, and violence, violence from our leaders. How should we interpret Montesquieu today through what we see on the TV every night?
Well, Montesquieu provides plenty of insight, extraordinary tips for understanding what the abuse of power, what arbitrary power entails. So we find running through his work, in particular The Spirit of the Laws, we find an important defense of liberty, the importance of living under laws that protect us from abuses of power of rulers. Despotism is destructive of diversity, of toleration. It is, in fact, a type of power that feeds upon prejudices. There is a passage where he describes prejudices as ces véritables monstres de l'esprit, something like the true monsters of the spirit. I mean, he has a deep, deep dislike of prejudices, and he thinks that these despotisms actually harness these prejudices. So one of the important legacies of Montesquieu is that he teaches us about the modernity of despotism. It's not an ancient problem, and it's certainly not an Eastern problem.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. A key takeaway from Montesquieu is that the dichotomy between East and West and the way that we might think about what's happening in terms of governance in the East and the West just breaks down when we look at a range of rulers around the world. Actually, they've got a lot in common here.
Yes, and it's Montesquieu who says it first. So despotism is a form of arbitrary power, typically with a despot at the helm. It's a form of power that is reckless and spreads fear. But despotism also works through time. It works to secure the voluntary servitude of the powerless. So all despots find a way of narrating themselves, of persuading people of the rightness of their particular views. All these despotisms, Montesquieu says, work because they build spider's webs of patronage. It's his phrase, in which there are patterns of dependency. You do something for me, in return I do something for you. Everybody is embroiled, drawn in to networks of soiled solidarity. Everybody is implicated. Kompromat is the Russian term. And all of these despotisms are prone to violence. He thinks that war may be a chronic feature of despotism, but certainly at home, there is the deployment of violence against those subjects who refuse that despotism. All of these features, for me, are very much alive in our period, and it's a key reason why I think that term despotism, which went out of fashion in the last generation, why it deserves a renaissance and why it is that it can be deployed to make sense of the realities of these years of the 21st century. And for that, we have to thank Montesquieu.
And how is it different to other terms that we might use, like dictator or autocrat or some other term?
Montesquieu, when using the term, and as I use the term, points out that it's a mistake to think that these systems of arbitrary power are dictated from above by a single ruler. They are more complex webs of power, of voluntary servitude. And for this reason, autocracy, dictatorship, tyranny are not the right terms. These are terms that are very much in circulation today, but they are misdescriptions of a more complex reality. This is the first point. Montesquieu did not know the term authoritarianism. That became the pet term for many journalists and scholars, citizens and representatives in this period to describe China, for example, or Russia, or Saudi, or Turkey. I think that the term is a zombie term. I think despotism has got clear advantages because these systems of power, these regimes, are not simply regimes that have risen and show signs of resilience because they brutalize their populations, because those who rule boss and bully their inferiors. We owe to Montesquieu the idea that despotisms are capable of actually nurturing our willing compliance, that they can win the loyalty of their powerless subjects. And I think these despotisms of the 21st century are experiments in where rulers learn the arts of cultivating loyalty. And they do this through elections, through the use of public opinion polling. So the key advantage, from my point of view, of the category of despotism is that it gets at this problem of voluntary servitude, which I think the category of authoritarianism doesn't. It lazily refers to systems of arbitrary power that ultimately rely on the subservience of populations because they're bossed and bullied and cowed. I think that misunderstands the way these new despotisms of the 21st century show a remarkable ability to seduce their subjects, to persuade them that there is no alternative and that they are actually superior to democracies of the American kind that are in a parlous state of disorder, of demagogy, of the spread of fake news and so on. There are many despots and people living within despotisms who feel proud to belong to systems of order where that kind of nonsense doesn't go on.
I'm thinking about the difference between somewhere like North Korea and Russia, China, America. And I think that that might be a good way of thinking about what the difference might be, where there is very much a hard power structure oppressing the people in North Korea, where in Russia, China, America, people are quite proud of the governance systems that sit above them.
Of course, the new despotisms of the 21st century are not all cut from the same cloth. There are differences, important differences among them. In Saudi Arabia, officially, alcohol is banned. In Russia, alcohol is the elixir of life. There is an old Russian joke that Putinism is 3 packets of cigarettes a day and 1 liter of vodka. So there are these differences. And yet, these despotisms are not totalitarian. They are not fascist in the sense that they require the mass mobilization of people who are afraid and filled with terror. Mass mobilization is not the defining quality of these despotisms. They prefer people to be quiet, to busy themselves with their households and with their jobs and to go shopping. So these are not totalitarian regimes, regimes of Mugabe's Zimbabwe kind, you know, reckless, violent, ruthless, kind of crazy. There is a commitment with China as the leader of the pack of these despots. There is a commitment by the rulers to learn how better to rule, to ward off crises, and to try to win the loyalty of populations. Central to Montesquieu's political thinking is a suspicion of concentrated power and the foolishness, and in the extreme cases, the evils that arbitrary power brings to people.
I guess it's the other thing for people facing down these kinds of authorities and these kinds of rule. It's not abstract, the force that you're up against here. Some at one remove, but it's also police with weapons and tear gas and batons and shields and horses. And we see that form repeating itself across the world.
Just as there is an encroaching despotism, there's also an empowered, strategic, wily social response that's emerging too, that is contesting that despotism or trying to contest that despotism where it arises.
Any political system that allows power to be concentrated in a few hands and where it's wielded over others, even in small-scale organizations, when that happens, then abuses of power can be expected. And the remedy is to break up that power, to check it, to have a division of powers so that there is accountability of those who exercise power for the public good.
John Keane, Professor of Politics at the University of Sydney and the author of The New Despotism. You also heard there from Associate Professor Kurt Iverson and Dr. Amanda Tattersall from the Organising Cities Project, also at the University of Sydney. And that story was produced by Dallas Rogers. Thanks for your company this week. This has been The Philosopher's Zone. You can find us via the RN website or the ABC Listen app. I'm David Rutledge. See you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.